You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, British Columbia.
Hi, I'm Andre Goulet. You're listening to Harbinger Showcase. Harbinger Showcase is a weekly podcast syndicated to community and campus radio, including CITR, CJSR, and Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Victoria's CFUV, CIVL in Abbotsford, ZKUW and CJUM in Winnipeg, at Met Radio in Toronto, at Radio Laurier in Waterloo, at CFMU in Hamilton, at CJM in Windsor, at Montreal CKUT, and at CJBU in Sydney, Nova Scotia. I'm featuring highlights from the country's favorite progressive podcast community. Since launching in 2020, the Harbinger Media Network's become Canada's number one listener-supported nonprofit podcast network, featuring 83 shows exploring politics, society, and culture from progressive perspective. Find out more about the community and subscribe to our weekly newsletter at harbingermedianetwork.com. On this episode, we talk about how movements are reckoning with Mark Carney's liberal agenda. On The Breach Show, explain why oil and gas's interests lie about the future of their projects while profiting from the war in Iran, on the environment in Canada, and unpack the fallout from Vancouver Mayor Ken Sim's false accusations that city councillors are dealing drugs on Red Eye. But first, this episode of Harbinger Showcase is brought to you by Canada's progressive journalism community, Unrigged. Launched in 2023 as a response to Meta's Canadian news ban, Unrigged.ca is a one-stop website aggregating and updating new journalism on the hour, including podcasts, videos, newsletters, and in-depth reporting from publishers like Briar Patch in Regina, The Grind in Toronto, The Independent in St. John's, and national publications like Press Progress, The Breach, The Maple, and 24 more. Bookmark the site and make it your daily destination for Canadian news at Unrigged.ca. This episode of Harbinger Showcase is also brought to you by the Alberta Advantage podcast. Based in Calgary, this collective of more than 20 activists, academics, and journalists have been broadcasting award-winning political commentary, news, and analysis since 2017. On this excerpt from a November 2020 episode, former Public Interest Alberta Executive Director Joel French talks about the province's unique relationship with American-style charter schools and how they relate to the broader changes happening in the public education system. Now, here's the show.
Alberta Advantage is supported by listeners like you. Independent, listener-supported media like this podcast is possible only thanks to the generous support of our listeners. If you think what we do is important, please head over to patreon.com/albertaadvantage and support our work with a monthly donation. Hello and welcome to the Alberta Advantage. My name is Kate Jacobson, and today we're going to be talking about public education and charter schools in Alberta. Joining me is Joel French, Executive Director of Public Interest Alberta. Joel, thank you for joining me here on Team Advantage.
Thanks for having me. Great to be back.
So some Albertans, and likely many Canadians, might not know that Alberta is the only jurisdiction in Canada where it is legal to operate a charter school. And many of our listeners may not even really know what differentiates a charter school from a public school. Could you explain the difference between these two forms of education to us?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're still at a point where a lot of Albertans don't actually know Alberta has charter schools, let alone that the rest of the country doesn't have them at all, that we're an outlier. Basically, how I explain charter schools is that they are private schools that get full public funding. So they operate in private schools in that they have the ability to pick their students, which also means they have the ability to reject students that they don't want. They generally have a very specialized kind of focus, which could be a lot of different things. And one of the very important points is that they are not accountable to democratically elected school boards. So they have their own private school boards that they report to. And therefore, you know, even though they receive, again, 100% per student public funding, they don't have to report back to the public. They're not accountable in the same way that private, Catholic, and Francophone schools have to be to their school boards.
So despite the presence of charter schools in Alberta, which, as you've explained, is kind of a legal irregularity in Canada, the number of charter schools in Alberta has remained constant, at least until now. So a 15-school cap on the number of charter schools had existed, but the United Conservative Party, who is currently in government, removed that cap. And now the Alberta government has given the green light to the first new charter school in 13 years, and the new charter school would operate in a building that was closed as a public school in June. Could you tell us a bit about the public school that was shut down, where it was located, and what was the justification for closing it?
Yeah, that public school is an elementary school. school in the town of Kalmar, which is just outside of Edmonton, pretty close to Leduc for those familiar with the area. And I don't know, I think it's symptomatic of what's happening in a lot of rural areas where the, in the urban areas, we talk a lot about the classrooms being overcrowded and that being a major issue and teachers and support staff being really stretched thin. In rural schools, often the challenge is the opposite. It's that they don't have enough students to fill a class, or the government or the school board says that they don't have enough, which just means they're not willing to spend the dollars to keep the class sizes as small as they are. But in some places, legitimately, they're very, very small, and it's very difficult to keep a school going if they don't have enough, because so many folks are moving to the cities from those smaller towns. And so the school board decided to close the school for those reasons. And I mean, it happens in urban areas as well, especially in core neighborhoods. We've seen a lot of schools closed over the years too, for somewhat similar reasons, I guess. But it's been fairly common as far as charter schools go for them to swoop in and scoop up public buildings. Many of the existing charter schools operate in properties that are still owned by school boards, and almost all of them are in Calgary and Edmonton or the surrounding area. I think it's important when we talk about the number of charter schools. So there has been a legislated cap of 15 since they were first introduced. We've never reached that cap before. So there are 13 charter schools occupying 23 school buildings. So when we say 13 schools, it doesn't mean 13 school buildings. It means 13 of these charter schools, which each have a board. So some of them operate multiple sites. And there is at least one in Calgary that has several sites. And so the problem is actually a little bigger than what we say, although in the grand scheme of things, when we're talking about student enrollment overall in charter schools in the province, we're really talking about a little more than 1% of the total student population. So they don't serve a huge number of students overall either.
What's a real curiosity to me about this specific case of the school in Kalmar being closed down is it is being replaced by a charter school. It's going to operate in the exact same building. How could it possibly make sense to open up a school in the exact same place as a public school that was deemed no longer viable to operate?
Yeah, I mean, the way that they're planning to do it is, like I mentioned earlier, charter schools generally have a really specific kind of target market. So this one is going to be an agricultural school. And so what they'll aim to do, if they're going to make it viable in some way, is to attract students that live outside, or maybe students that live in that area that have chosen to go to other schools, because that's something that you can do in parts of Alberta. So they're going to be hoping that they can attract enough students that think this is a good kind of program that have to travel further to get there. Interestingly, a lot of public school boards actually do that kind of thing. And I have mixed feelings about it. Like Edmonton Public Schools, for example, is at the forefront of it in Alberta, and CBE in Calgary is somewhat similar, but not as far ahead as Edmonton Public, where they have what they call alternative programs in public schools. And I mean, in my view, some of those are really problematic too. And some of them actually operate somewhat like private schools in the sense of being able to have a lengthy and really difficult application and qualification standards and application processes, which means that they can accept and reject students in the same way that I mentioned charter schools do. They are still accountable to public school boards, but this will be a school that further splinters the public education systems overall in the province. I think administratively, they are much less efficient because each of them has its own administration and financial accounting to do. So it splinters a lot of that. And then the local folks that go to that school, maybe it is a lot of the folks that used to go to the public school that was closed. They no longer get the same kind of accountability out to the public, the members of the community that actually pay tax dollars into making sure these schools operate. There's not the same kind of transparency. So it's much more difficult to tell if the money is being properly spent, if the school is operating in a transparent in a healthy way. So I think there are all kinds of problems that could be caused. And I mean, we'll see ultimately, assuming that the rest of the process goes through and that they end up opening it, if it is in fact a viable school, or if it's, maybe some kind of pipe dream that they just hope people are really demanding right now.
So this kind of starving of funds that you've outlined, and more generally, the erosion of trust in the public education system, does really seem to be a priority for the UCP government. In late October, the recommended changes to the kindergarten to grade 4 curriculum were leaked, and among the many recommendations were these proposals, and included lumping in Canada's history of residential schools with, quote, harsh schooling in the past, end quote, like Dickensian schooling and 19th century discipline. And the leaked document actually explained that residential schools are too sad for children to learn about. It also recommended that 7- and 8-year-olds learn about feudalism, Chinese dynasties, Homer's Odyssey, and social studies classes, that young children memorize lengthy lists of names, landmarks, and dates, that 5- and 6-year-olds in grade 1 should be familiar with the artwork of artists like Claude Monet and Georgia O'Keeffe, and that first graders should learn that biblical and indigenous verses about creation as poetry, and that fourth graders should learn that most non-white Albertans are Christians, among a litany of similarly truly bizarre recommendations. And after this, there were calls from the Alberta Teachers Association that one of the province's main curriculum advisors, Chris Champion, be fired, in particular because he called the inclusion of First Nations perspectives in Canadian curriculums a fad and cast doubt on the suffering of children who experienced residential schools. And I'm kind of curious, like, what do you think is going on with this curriculum review, with the way it was leaked, and then the way the government kind of talked about it, and more broadly with this government and public education in Alberta?
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack there, obviously. I think that that this government, ironically, given the accusations it made against the NDP government, but its ideology is dominating this curriculum process, or at least what we've seen of it so far. I mean, so much of it has been quite secretive. And in fact, you mentioned this was a leaked document. This wasn't even something that they intended to be out to the public, because they've been keeping everything kind of hush-hush and behind closed doors. You know, I think they were really caught off guard. I think they're going to be under a lot of pressure now to really make some serious changes. I mean, some of those things seem frankly just out of touch, which is bad enough. But I mean, some of it is clearly rooted in racism and intolerance. And you know, I guess those shouldn't be surprising things coming from this government, given some of the things that we've seen from them so far. But I think Albertans rightly are quite outraged right now that these are even proposals, and that this is coming from a panel of folks that the UCP appointed. And so I think they're really breaking down a lot of trust in the process before the process is even out there publicly. I think they really owe Albertans an explanation and an apology. I don't think there was a good reason for them to, as they called it, shred the NDP's curriculum review process that had happened. I think the NDP made a mistake back when they launched this, their initial process, in making it so they made it seem very political from the start. They had the premier as the face of this. And, you know, normally when there's a big curriculum review, which definitely needed to be done, it's something that's done a lot more within the bureaucracy and isn't typically as much of a public debate. But, you know, we are where we are today. And it seems like, I mean, the Kenny government, just like it's done on so many other files, is taking something that I think was going quite well, even though, like I said, I think process wise, the NDP made some slip ups. But I think what they were coming up with, as far as the curriculum went, was seemed like it was going to be quite good and quite forward thinking. And now the Kenny government is swinging us back to, I don't even know what decade you would say, if this is back to the 50s or something like that. But in lots of ways, I mean, this is a very old fashioned and outdated and out of touch process from how it looks so far. And so it's not final yet. So it's really up to the government now to give their heads a shake and pick a completely different direction than what they have so far. But it's tough to see how that could happen, given how far they've gone down that path.
So if our listeners are concerned about what is going on broadly with public education in Alberta, with either charter schools or curriculum changes or both, what should they do?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot that folks can do. I think having these conversations in their communities is the place to start. But getting in touch with their politicians, whether they're conservative or NDP politicians, I think it's important that those politicians hear from the people that they are supposed to represent in the legislature. And honestly, I think joining some of these, a cause like this, joining it to some of the other things that are happening right now. I'm thinking of something like the Wildcat strike that healthcare workers were on recently, you know, going out and joining with those folks and realizing that a lot of those folks on the picket lines, you know, trying to protect our public healthcare from privatization, a lot of those folks have the same concerns as we're talking about today about privatization and charter schools, as well as expansion of private schools in the education system. And about curriculum and the wrong ways that that is going. I think Albertans really need to join together across these different lines, because I think we have a lot of values in common, whether you're working on K-12 issues or healthcare issues or climate change issues or, you know, workers' rights and occupational health and safety. I really think that that we need to connect together. So the folks that are concerned about this, you know, find some folks that are concerned about these other issues, and they're not difficult to find given how public some of these things have been. I think that's what's really necessary is solidarity between these different groups to really make a difference, to make Albertans pay a lot more attention and to put a higher priority on these issues, and therefore really to make politicians of all political parties feel the pressure to do something completely different than what we're getting right now.
There's also some organizations that are doing great work on this front. Support Our Students is one that we've had on our podcast before, and I think they do some really, really wonderful work. And also, you know, your organization, Public Interest Alberta. And if our listeners, you know, want to find out more about you and your work with Public Interest Alberta, where should they be looking?
Yeah, I love the work of Support Our Students Alberta too. I definitely encourage people to get involved there. But for us, they can go to pialberta.org. And I mean, what I just talked about connecting those issues, that's a lot of what we're designed to do as an organization, because we do a lot of work on these K-12 issues that we're talking about today, but we work on issues like climate change, poverty, seniors care, and we work really to connect a lot of these efforts and make sure that people can see the big picture and understand what's going on kind of across those areas in Alberta, and really prepare ourselves and get ourselves all on the same page so that we can fight back effectively against the regressive agenda of this government.
Joel, thank you so much for joining us here on this mini episode of the Alberta Advantage. Is there anything that we didn't get to or that I didn't ask that you think is really important that our listeners know about public education and the attacks on it?
Oh, I think we covered a lot today. I really appreciate your time and the opportunity to be here.
Amazing.
The Alberta Advantage is supported by listeners like you. Independent, listener-supported media like this podcast is possible only thanks to the generous support of our listeners. If you think what we do is important, please head over to patreon.com/AlbertaAdvantage and support our work with a monthly donation.
There's a highlight from the Legacy 2020 episode of The Alberta Advantage. Find out more about the show at albertaadvantagepod.com and hear the rest of the conversation at harbingermedianetwork.com. You listen to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. I'm Harbinger Director Andre Goulet in Montreal. Coming up next. Broadcasting since 2022, The Breach Show is a bi-weekly podcast featuring sharp commentary on politics and movements in Canada. On this highlight from a recent episode at a panel hosted at the Broadbent Institute's Progress Summit in Ottawa. In March 2026, editor Martin Lukacs sits down with organizers Syed Hassan, Atiyah Jafar, Janelle Lapointe, Nathan Prier, and Rachel Small to discuss how movements are reckoning with Mark Carney's liberal agenda. Now, here's the show.
Welcome to The Breach Show, featuring sharp analysis on politics and social movements in Canada. I'm your host, Martin Lukacs. Today, we're airing a panel discussion with frontline organizers on fighting the Carney liberal agenda. The panel was recorded last week in Ottawa at the Broadbent Institute's yearly summit.
Back in October, our Prime Minister, Mark Carney, made an interesting admission to a U.S. media outlet. He was asked what he has learned from Donald Trump. And this is what he said. I don't fully subscribe to this, but I see the effectiveness, the value of flooding the zone, of doing multiple things at the same time. Flooding the zone, of course, is the term of Stephen Bannon's, Donald Trump's MAGA strategist, and refers to the torrent of policy and legislation intended to disorient and overwhelm any opposition, and is what has been unleashed by Donald Trump, both in his first term in office and this time around as well. And that is precisely what Mark Carney has overseen in his own first year, a veritable tsunami of pro-corporate policies and legislation under the cover of the disorientation and shock of the Trump attacks against Canada. The brilliant organizers and leaders you're going to hear from today are on the front lines of that flood, trying to reckon with the massive changes that Carney has unleashed in this country and figuring out how to fight back against them. So let me introduce the speakers today. Janelle Lapointe is a climate justice and Indigenous rights organizer from the Stilladen First Nation and senior advisor at the David Suzuki Foundation. Saeed Hassan is the executive director of the Migrant Workers Alliance for Change and on the Secretariat of the Migrant Rights Network. Rachel Small is the Canada lead for World Beyond War and a founding member of Jews Say No to Genocide. Atiyah Jafar is the team lead for the climate justice organization 350 Canada team. And Nathan Pryor is the president of the Canadian Association of Professional Employees, or CAPE, which represents 28,000 federal sector workers. So in no particular order, Janelle, I thought we could start with you.
I'm from a small village called Stella, which is located in the north central part of so-called BC. It's my matrilineal homelands, the place where my grandmother was born, and a place that is so beautiful to me, abundant. Early settlers write about just how abundant the land was and how well we took care of the land. But it's also a place that I think tells a story about what has happened here in Canada. Massive extraction from the fur trade, forestry, mining, and now oil and gas. We struggle with soaring costs of groceries, a crumbling healthcare system, and now a fast-tracked agenda to continued extraction without Indigenous consent. What we know is that Indigenous people have been systematically excluded from the economy since contact. And I think people don't realize the recent implications of that. And in the area where I grew up, that meant that two generations before me, people who are still alive, my grandmother's age, were not allowed to seek employment off the reserve without permission from an Indian agent. And people were not going out of their way to create jobs on the reserve. So when we hear promises of jobs and you're wondering like why this tactic is working so well in Indigenous communities, it's because jobs and employment has been very recently weaponized against us, and Indigenous people are facing the systemic impoverization while corporation after corporation, while the colonial governments have gotten rich at our expense. And in fact, a new tactic had emerged where corporations were spending more time in my community. They now have Indigenous engagement employees who are paid massive salaries to just come and talk and build relationships with my people. They're sponsoring community barbecues. They're, you know, showing up and chatting with our elders. And more cynical than that, they're also filling the gap that the government had failed to for decades. This was in an era, of course, of a Justin Trudeau liberal agenda where he ran on a reconciliation platform, overpromised and severely underdelivered. We had arsenic poisoned water for several decades in my community. Arsenic cannot be boiled out. Poisoned water from the mine, molybdenum mine runoff near my community. And the only way we were able to afford a water treatment center was not from government support, but from saying yes to an oil and gas pipeline that we did not want. We are in a circumstance where our fluent speakers are rapidly passing on, and we were able to build a language center from money from a pipeline that we did not want. And this has become a tactic that all forms of governments are taking, and they're using this really pretty term, you may have heard it, called economic reconciliation, which means that how we do reconciliation is to allow corporations to give the wealth that Ottawa has stolen from people back to community. And when I first heard this term, I thought, oh man, are they going to give cash back? Are we getting reparations? Like the term economic reconciliation, I thought we were talking about, you know, repairing our traditional economy, allowing us to lead a new economy But what it really has come to mean is that we have to assimilate in this capitalist colonial framework, the same framework that has put us in the position that we're in. In this new circumstance where we have a Carney as leader, he's really weaponizing the threat of Donald Trump and saying that we need these major projects and we need them now. He quickly adopted this framework. And so what that means is we now have fast-tracking legislation, Bill C-5, as well as provincial counterparts in BC and Ontario, that put these major resource projects forward and remove some of the safeguards that we had, like environmental assessments and consultation processes that were already severely flawed. So what we're up against now is, when Martin, you say flooded the zone, I came to my mind that, Indigenous communities have been dealing with a flooded zone for a long time. We are severely stretched, under capacity, and already struggling to keep up with the amount of claims that come across the desk to our land. And so now we have these major projects that have extreme risks to our lands, our waters, our culture, our safety of our women and girls, that bring in man camps, strange men from across the country to our vulnerable communities, that have to use our health, crumbling health services, and often get priority to some of the spaces that we've been excluded from. And we are told that that is a gift to us. I think the most sinister part of it is how the Carney government has repackaged this as generosity and as reconciliation. And now we're in a situation where Indigenous governments are likely going to be taking out massive loans to build some of these projects. In my community, the biggest threats are LNG and the electrification projects that are going to power LNG and data centers over homes. We are being told that these projects are financially prosperous and, frankly, that they're going to happen without us, that we will consult, but ultimately the decision comes down to the major projects office and the hand-selected Indigenous people that already have vested interests in these extractive projects to make the decision for us. And my worry about where the movement is at is I think we've adopted a tactic post-Idle No More of waiting for Indigenous people to lead. I think the movement is waiting for another Wet'suwet'en to happen, waiting for militarized police to be on the front lines, and then maybe we'll pay attention. But the government is playing chess. They are seeing that the rights and title of Indigenous people, the story of this country is becoming more mainstream, and that the support for Indigenous governance is growing, and they're weaponizing that. They are saying, if you support Indigenous rights and title, well, what do you think about this Indigenous-owned pipeline? And it's working. It's working. That is a chess move that I wish we had been more prepared for. And we have a word for that, when we get impoverished people to take out massive loans that will have no return on investment. We call that predatory lending. We do not call that economic reconciliation. And when I put it that way, it makes sense why our banker prime minister has been so goddamn good at using this tactic. So it's really important that we build those strong relationships, that we call out that narrative, and that we engage with communities to address this crisis of economic imagination that's not only plaguing Indigenous communities, but is plaguing us across Canada. I mean, the fact that we can't come up with another project to provide 200 temporary jobs in an LNG region is pretty pathetic. But that, to me, is a really exciting piece of the work that to defeat the Carney agenda, we get to work more closely together, and that we get to get into a dream space and start thinking about economic solutions that work for Indigenous communities and non-Indigenous communities across the country.
The abundance of choices here. How about you, Hassan?
Maybe what I'll do is I'll just briefly talk about, like, what is immigration policy? What is immigration justice? What is Carney doing about it? Right now, every year, 4 times more people come into the country on temporary permits, on study permits, on work permits, as refugee claimants. Most of these people pay most of the taxes, but don't get most of the services, are people who are in farms and fishery plants and healthcare and on logistics and in packing, are coming here effectively in a revolving door immigration system. We come here for a few years, and as our members say to us, you people treat us like chewing gum. Come, chew us, then when you're done with us, you spit us out. Every year, hundreds of thousands of people are coming in into this country, denied basic rights and freedoms, and then eventually becoming undocumented. That has been the system for a very long time. What has really shifted in the last couple of years is the shift towards a particular form of scapegoating that is emerging as we are entering into a global recession, right? We have to name what that is. Right now,